Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
I know a lot of people out there seem to think that I don't get angry. That's just not true. I get angry a lot.
If you're not mad, you're not paying attention.
If politeness isn't getting you anywhere, maybe it's time to unleash your political fury.
You remember my anger translator, Luther.
Why, hello.
Is anger counterproductive?
When someone calls out injustice, don't criticize their tone.
Punching up, punching down? What if we all just stop punching each other?
It's all part of rough and tumble politics.
I hate you!
Where do you draw the line between righteous rage and ruthless revenge?
Usually when we think about anger, we think about fury and not necessarily grief.
Our guest is Maisha Cherry, author of The Case for Rage, Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle.
Anger at injustice.
Righteous rage.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Wednesday, March 8th, come be part of a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about the philosophy of smell with experimental psychologist Asfa Majid.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody's welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Wednesday, March 8th at 7 p.m. in Leventhal Hall of the Stanford Humanities Center.
Smell you later. Shouldn't we get angry at injustice?
Won't rage just beget more rage?
Don't some things deserve our anger?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy, and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about righteous rage.
Righteous rage. That sounds like an oxymoron to me, Ray. I mean, is righteousness really about rage and destruction? I think it's more about building something, building a world that's kind, fair, and loving.
Well, yeah, Josh, I want to live in that world too. But just look around you. There's injustice everywhere. You know, dictators oppressing their citizens, corporations destroying the environment, neo-Nazis spewing racism everywhere. Doesn't it just make you mad?
Well, okay. I mean, I definitely do get mad sometimes. I'm only human, but, you know, I kind of wish I didn't get mad as much of the time. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be one of those people who flies into a rage every time someone cuts them off in traffic.
I'm not talking about road rage. It doesn't matter if someone cuts you off in traffic. Getting upset about that is just petty and self-centered. I'm talking about anger at social injustice. That matters enough. You should get upset about it. I mean, how are we ever going to change the system if we just let ourselves get complacent?
Well, I mean, I totally agree that the system is unfair, but the question I'm asking is anger the solution? Think about what Seneca said. He says, look at all the people committing all those atrocious crimes. If you got as angry at them as they deserve, you'd go mad with rage. You'd end up with torches and pitchforks, revenge killing, whole cities being sacked.
I'm not defending murder, but you don't have to kill someone every time you get angry. Like, look, there are more productive ways to channel your emotions. You could speak out against injustice, or you could join an activist movement and agitate for change.
Yeah, but even if you're not, you know, killing anyone or sacking cities or something, I mean, still, aren't there better emotions to appeal to, like love?
Why not both? I mean, you can be angry because you're sticking up for someone you love, or you can be angry at someone you love because you expect better from them. I'm not against love. What have you got against anger anyway?
Well, okay, here's one thought. Sometimes anger can be off-putting. You know, so suppose there's someone who cares about you and wants to help you, but, you know, you just rant and rave at them about how unfair the world is, like I do sometimes. I mean, don't you think they'll be a little turned off?
Well, yeah, some people are just turned off the instant anybody criticizes them or has any kind of difficult emotion. But that's kind of on them, don't you think? I mean, if somebody can't tolerate your anger, do they really even love you? Do they even count as an ally?
Well, maybe those friends and family members are wrong to get put off. I totally take that point. But that doesn't change the fact that they sometimes do get put off. In fact, quite a lot of the time, I think that happens. You know, anger sometimes scares away potential allies. So even when it's completely justified, my worry is it can still be damaging to the cause.
Well, okay, but I still think anger has a lot of benefits that you're not seeing. You know, it can be a sign of self-respect. If somebody treats you unfairly because of your race or your gender or your disability, sticking up for yourself is a way of saying, hey, I'm actually worth something. And sticking up for other people is a way of showing respect for them.
That's a really good point, especially when it's the person getting angry on their own behalf. But I'm not necessarily entirely convinced about cases where it's someone getting angry for the sake of other people. That can sometimes just be a way of drawing attention to yourself.
Yeah, fair enough. I've seen that happen too, and I don't really know what to say about it. But I bet our guest does. It's Maisha Cherry, the author of a new book, The Case for Rage: Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle.
Thinking of anger and the fight for justice, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk to two longtime organizers about how righteous rage has fueled their activism. She files this report.
The Occupy movement of 2011 didn't last long, just a few months. But the rallying cry against severe wealth disparities, "We are the 99%, didn't go away after the tents came down. It happened as people were still reeling from the financial crisis of 2008. Protesters had set up tent cities, first near Wall Street, and then in cities around the world. One of them was in Oakland, California.
This crowd has righteous anger. That is a part of being human.
During a march there, captured on video, two people debated the role of anger in organizing. One protester says diversity of tactics is needed. Another disagreed and said you need to convert anger into compassion.
Now, anger is a bipartisan fear.
At one point, the crowd chants, "Fight back." During one of those marches, police fired tear gas and baton rounds, severely injuring one protester.
I guess I would define righteous rage as rage that's justifiable.
Kat Brooks was one of the organizers there with Occupy Oakland.
That rage gets triggered by the daily micro and macro aggression.
Now Brooks is with the Anti-Police Terror Project, a coalition with a stated goal of eradicating police terror in communities of color. She says any organizer working on social justice issues taps into righteous rage. That's how you get people out to city council meetings and out into the streets. But anger, unaddressed, can also make people sick and unhealthy.
I'm an older head in the movement, and I was raised in the organizing school of drink, smoke, work to death, die.
She saw people burn out and drop out of the movement. Now she says younger organizers are more clear about setting boundaries and not overworking themselves. Anger is one thing, but she also feels a lot of deep sadness.
I'm working with a family now where the mother was really adamant that I look at the pictures of her dead son on a slab, on a metal slab after he'd been beaten to death by LA County sheriffs. And I sobbed for hours. It's exhausting to be sitting in this work all of the time, to be, you know, acutely aware of injustice every waking moment of every single day.
But sometimes anger can be an antidote to exhaustion.
When you're angry about something, the synapses start going and your energy comes back. It's very hard to be in a rage and be tired at the same time.
Jennifer Friedenbach is with the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco, a group that organizes with unhoused people. She says she feels every emotion several times a day.
It's just, you know, defeat, tiredness, and then being energized by something that is really wrong.
Like last December, when San Francisco Mayor London Breed talked about cracking down on drug users and dealers. Friedenbach says a lot of people who showed up at the Board of Supervisors meeting were angry that addiction was being criminalized.
Did you even talk to any homeless people? Vote no and get something real in writing. Vote no on Mayor Giuliani's war on drugs. Vote no on Black Lives Don't Matter.
Righteous rage is a tool for organizers, but you rarely hear journalists publicly acknowledging their own anger. That's what happened recently in an episode of the podcast Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's during a series looking at racial justice called Mississippi Goddamn.
I think it's beautiful that you want to inspire people. I do. I love that about you.
That's host Al Edson talking to reporter Jonathan Jones.
And in certain ways, I do want to do work that inspires people. But really, at this point in my life and where I am, I don't want to inspire people. I want to infuriate people. I want to make work that make people burn so hard that they feel like this injustice is wrong and they want to go out and they want to tear it all down.
Alabama's got me so upset.
Righteous anger in songs and storytelling can push people to act. The question from there becomes, what's next? What happens in the aftermath of the rage? Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly T. McDeed.
Thanks for that energizing report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about righteous rage.
We're joined now by Maisha Cherry. She's professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, host of the Unmute podcast, and author of The Case for Rage, Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. Maisha, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
So Maisha, your new book, which I love, by the way, focuses specifically on anger as a tool for political change. But you've also written about other emotions like forgiveness and empathy. So how did you first get interested in the emotions?
Well, it was 2012. Trayvon Martin was killed. And I was trying to make sense of my own anger in response to that. Also trying to make sense of the anger of other activists. And also trying to make sense of why people was angry that other people was angry. And so I went down a rabbit hole, and it's been going ever since.
So Maisha, you believe that anger is good, but you don't believe that all anger is good. So what's special about the good kind?
Well, the good kind has particular features that is different from the bad kind. And one of the interesting things about the good kind is that it aims for change, it aims for transformation. Another thing about the good kind is that the perspective that influences it or that guides it is an inclusive perspective. So it's concerned not just about oneself, but about others. And it's also directed at a actual wrongdoing, racism, racist attitudes, racist people. But the whole point of the anger is to bring about transformation in our world, to make it a better world for everyone.
I love all of those points, and I wanted to add something back in from your excellent book. Another thing that you say is that it's also rational, which is a kind of a surprising thing. Maybe you don't use that word, but you talk about it being, you know, the good kind of anger being a considered anger, not an impulsive anger, but it's the result of a long time living, experiencing, thinking, reflecting. That sounds like a really healthy kind of anger.
Yeah, it's a kind of anger that comes about as a result of evaluating the world and simply suggesting that what I see, what I am experiencing, is not right. And so it's a moral proclamation to make people aware that an injustice has happened, that a wrongdoing has occurred, and that it needs to be rectified. And to do that, it takes rational capacities. Right. So it's not this impulsive thing that's just all about the emotions, that's all about feelings, but it comes about through an evaluative process.
So Maisha, you're view on anger differs from what a lot of philosophers have said. So a lot of philosophers have said that anger is never justified and always destructive. So where do you think they've gone wrong?
So anytime you hear a philosopher that say that something is always the case, or anyone says that something is always the case, we know we have encountered a problem there.
Because except one of the things, that sentence.
Exactly. So one of the things that I'm very conscious of is even as I defend anger, I simply suggest that it's not perfect, that it does not always go right. So you need to make room that individuals that experience emotions are human beings. And so that suggests that we can indeed make mistakes. But I think the problem with the assumption that it's always wrong, it's just inaccurate, right? I think that if you direct it towards the right thing, I mean, I'm gonna sound like Aristotle here, direct it towards the right thing, that you aim it at a particular transformation, like I said before, the perspective that influence it, then you have the good kind and it will allow us to have positive results. I think the what people are concerned about, as you already alluded to, is a cynica that people get angry and it leads to violence, but not all anger leads to violence, right? Fear can also lead to violence. So we shouldn't, paint anger in broad strokes as if all kinds of anger does the same thing or achieves the same results.
I worry sometimes about anger having results that don't match the aim. Like, could there be cases where what I want is, something politically good, but then, I don't know, my anger is like in the Arab Spring, where some old and deeply unjust government gets overthrown, and what replaces it is not something politically better, but some other awful oppressive system.
Yeah, one might say, I mean, who's replacing it with what? I mean,
right.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, not every, we live in a non-ideal world. We want to hope that what we witness is wrong, and we want to hope that that wrong can be remedied. But it doesn't suggest that just because we have the righteous kind of anger that I'm referring to, that we're always going to get the perfect results, right? I think it depends on context. And it's just not just up to the angry individual to make sure that the story ends perfectly, right? It takes a society. And then for lots of situations, when certain governments get into power, that doesn't just come about because the people desire that to happen. Things can go wrong. But I'm simply suggesting that the kind of anger that I'm referring to, that it's more prone to go right given certain kinds of circumstances.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about righteous rage with Maisha Cherry from the University of California at Riverside.
Is it ever okay to be angry? Do some things demand our fury? How can we tell the difference between righteous indignation and destructive rage?
When to get mad, when to stay calm, and how to know the difference. Along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues.
Simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad.
When you remember these kinds of things, is rage the best response? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about righteous rage with Maisha Cherry from UC Riverside, author of The Case for Rage.
We're pre-recording this episode, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls, but you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Maisha, we were talking earlier about the difference between the good kind of anger and the bad kind. So how can somebody tell which one they're experiencing or somebody else is experiencing?
So one of the things that I hope to accomplish in the book, I mean, even before someone gets to the middle of the book, that's the first thing that I try to address. And I think that if you go back to the features that I kind of laid out earlier, is that one can ask oneself several questions. What is that anger directed at, right? So if it's directed at scapegoats and not really the real issue or the real problem, then we know we have encountered a problem, right? If I'm only thinking about justice for myself, then we know we have encountered a problem. If I don't aim to bring about a better world for everyone, but I aim rather to hit back at the world for hitting back at me, then we know we have encountered a problem. And so I'm hoping to build a kind of emotional intelligence in us all, that we all have the capability to evaluate if our anger has gone wrong. And I think starting with those questions are important.
So I really liked your distinction between anger that's about getting justice for, like, people in general versus anger that's just about a personal grievance. And I have some like tricky cases that I don't know how to feel about where they seem halfway in between.
Okay.
So I'm thinking things like white women campaigning for suffrage.
Right.
Where like it really was unjust that they weren't allowed to vote, but there was an exclusion of black women that seems like sort of really parochial and unfair and wrong. And so, like, what do I say about that kind of anger?
Yeah, I mean, you can say that it falls short, right? So if I could build a range that I kind of lay out, I start with something called rogue rage. One might say that that's probably the most extreme kind. And then I end with kind of defending an account that I call Lordian rage, which is righteous rage that I defend in the book. But there's an anger that kind of is almost close to Lordian rage that one might say that the suffragists kind of experience is what I call narcissistic rage, right? So it has kind of all the similar features that Lordian rage has. But like you said, that last part, it doesn't have an inclusive perspective, right? It's leading out other women that exist in society that are co-citizens, right? And one can say, hey, it does right. It's aimed at the right thing. It's directed towards the right targets. But one can say it doesn't have an inclusive perspective and one can evaluate it as such. I think there's nothing wrong with that. What we might suggest to that person that's experiencing that kind of rage, such as the suffragists, is that, hey, that's good. Narcissistic rage is good, but keep moving to that other direction. I want people to move into the righteous rage that I'm defending, which is the Lordian rage. And that will suggest, hey, you're almost there. If you broaden your perspective about who justice should include, then we can say that you've reached that real righteous anger that I think can really bring about true transformation in our world.
So Maisha, you mentioned Lordian rage, and I know from your book that that's named after Audre Lorde. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Yes. So the whole book is inspired by the poet feminist Audre Lorde from her famous essay, The Uses of Anger. So that's where I borrow the term from. And just reading that essay, I mean, she kind of inspired the features that I talk about in the book. And it's interesting because you asked a question about suffragists. And she writes the essay in response to white feminists that she's in solidarity with. And they are focused on defeating the patriarchy, but they're unaware of their own racism. So they have narcissistic rage. Right. But not the kind of anger that Lorde wants to bring them or make them aware of that they should have. So Lordean rage is inclusive. And those who don't have a full inclusive perspective are like the suffragists. They have a kind of semi-righteous anger, but they're not quite there yet.
One of the things I love in the way you characterize Lordean rage, this good kind of rage, this appropriate kind of rage, is the benefits it has. Both for society and for the individual. Right. You know, for society, it raises consciousness. It's often efficacious, right? It often brings about change. And of course, for the individual, it's energizing. It gives people courage. And it also, this is interesting. Why don't you say a little bit more about this, if you would, gives people a sense of dignity. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm going to try not to go on a tangent with this because I can talk about this all day, right? But I believe that, listen, there's a connection between value, respect, and anger, right? That one, when one has a sense of respect, that when one is wronged, that one is going to feel angry in response to that because they're going to feel like they are due a kind of respect given the kind of value that they have over their lives. And so Aristotle is quick to say a person that doesn't get angry is a fool, right? It's very much connected with self-respect. And so if anybody doesn't witness my rage, if I never go to a protest, the fact that I responded to a wrongdoing done to me is an expression of respect that I have for myself. So I don't need white society or white feminists to proclaim or amen that particular respect. The fact that I am getting angry at the lack of respect that has been given to me because I believe that I have value is one of the valuable things about anger that I find wonderful. So I don't need an audience, but audience does matter in certain kind of contexts, but it doesn't require an audience to proclaim that particular dignity and respect.
So I have a question about that. So in your book, you're really careful not to tell anybody that they should be feeling right this way or that way, and just to defend anger as a sign of self-respect. And one thing I wonder about is whether it's possible to like fail by not being angry enough, and like what I should do if I find myself in a situation where I'm like, I should be angry, but I'm just depressed now.
Yeah, so it goes back to the part of the question when you say angry enough. I don't know what that enough is, and I kind of question and trouble that enough, right? I think listen, us as human beings, we experience a whole variety of situations and a whole variety of emotions, and they're not on par with the way that we felt probably the day before, let alone on par with somebody else's experience, right? So I want to allow for what I call emotional diversity, given our dispositions, given about who we are. There's certain kind of emotions and there's certain kind of intensity that we have in relationship, that emotion that is just different. I mean, I must admit, I'm a very indignant person. I wrote a book on anger. My sister's not that indignant. My best friend is not that indignant. So what they get angry about and the enough kind of scale is going to be different given our particular disposition. So I don't want to judge someone. The fact that they don't have anger. I think anger is a moral emotion, but it's not the only moral emotion. But I would suggest, I don't believe anyone who says that they never get angry. I just don't believe that particular report. And I think a lot of people who say that they never get angry are usually people who are often punished for being angry socially, such as women, such as minorities. And so I hope that they read the book and they have the desire and the courage to proclaim the anger for themselves.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about righteous rage with Maisha Cherry from UC Riverside. And we actually have an email, or rather a comment on the website that connects really nicely to this question of how much anger is called for. So Daniel asks, what if someone claims that slavery in the Americas never occurred? And someone objects to this and calmly sits down and tries to explain the historical evidence which refutes that. Wouldn't one who observes this exchange be justifiably angry at the emotional indifference to the violence of such a claim and the notion that it should be entertained at all? How could one who becomes angry in response to angerlessness escape responsibility for the public expression of that anger? So there's a lot in there, but what do you think? Like, would that be a situation where that's too little anger, as Ray was saying a moment ago?
So I think all of us have a part to play in the moral landscape in which we live. Some people's role would be the calm person who sits down and educate others. And then someone else's role is the one that kind of incite things just a little bit to remind people where we should be and where we need to be. And that would be the angry person. I mean, when we think about the civil rights movement, for example, I mean, Martin Luther King played the role as a loving person. Now, mind you, in the book, I suggest that he did get angry. But as far as the public display of anger and the ways that a lot of radical people wish that he did was quite different than the Black Power movement. But I would say that both of them had a role to play in getting civil rights and getting equality for Blacks. And I think that that's not just the case for the 60s, but it's also the case for the present. All of us each have a role to play. And if we all play our roles, then we can all be morally and politically educated and challenged to do the right thing and to build a better world.
This position is really interesting to me because it sounds kind of similar to something else I've heard that I think is wrong, but different.
Uh-oh, okay.
No. I don't think that you're actually saying the thing I think is wrong.
Let's do it. I kind of bypassed the question just a little bit. I don't think I fully laid out my full view, but go right ahead,
So, I mean, one view that I've sometimes heard people express is that emotions are just kind of morally irrelevant. Like, what matters is that you say true things and that you do good actions. And it seemed like you're saying like anger is morally good in many situations, right, but it's not the only morally good emotion. Right. So emotions are morally relevant, but they're differently morally relevant from each other.
Exactly. Yes. And one of the things that I want to challenge people is to build their moral toolkit in relationship to emotion. So, you know, one of the things that I suggest is that anger is compatible with love. I think you all kind of talked about this early in the show. And so if you, particularly the kind of righteous anger that I'm defending, when that's on the scene, you also have love. But you also have compassion. You also have pity. And there are certain kinds of ways or particular social context in which one emotion would do a better job than the other emotion, right? But one of the things that I'm proclaiming that we have a tendency to beat up on that very valuable moral emotion such as anger. And I'm trying to remind us, let's not get rid of this too quickly because it has a very specific role to play that's quite different from meekness, that's quite different from solely pity or compassion. I mean, Bishop Butler, a famous British moralist, he basically suggests, hey, if we got rid of anger, he's concerned that justice would never get done. Right? He believes that we are always compassionate towards the wrongdoer, then we would never exercise true justice in the world. So he finds that anger allows us to achieve justice in ways that compassion alone is not able to do. So I think emotions are, you know, they all have a role to play and they can be very present and do very different things in the same similar social moment.
So one of the things that's cool to me about this view is that it's compatible with moral criticism of emotions, which you do in your book. So it seems like, you know, anger bad, meekness good is just like a really blunt toolkit. Like, I'd like more suggestions about how to develop a more sophisticated toolkit for criticizing emotions.
So reductive, right? So there's one emotion that we don't really criticize. So particularly when it comes to love, the Greeks has helped us note that there's very different varieties of love. Right. So the kind of love that I have for my partner is very different from the love that I have for my mother. We are able to distinguish different kinds of love and see the ways in which they play out in our different relationships. We don't tend to do that with what we call negative emotions. And I'm trying to challenge us to see that even one singular emotion has very different expressions, can go right, can go wrong, because even love can go wrong. Right. The stalkish kind, the obsessive kind, can go wrong. So love in general is just not always perfect. So I think there's several varieties of even one particular emotion. And I think we need to add some nuance to our conversations about emotions in general.
So Maisha, I mean, I love that. And that was certainly one of the things I appreciated the most about your book was this incredibly helpful way of distinguishing between kinds of anger and singling out this particularly healthy and helpful and constructive and socially meaningful kind. But I couldn't help thinking about my own anger at injustice and how that's gone. And it hasn't always gone great. And so I wanted to ask you, I don't want this to sound like a can you help me kind of show.
I'm here for you.
Yeah. But, you know, these past few years have been hard for many of us. And it's certainly, obviously, I'm better off in many ways than many people. But, you know, I've had some anger at social media companies for fomenting discord in it. Certain, you know, news outlets for, you know, normalizing fascism. I mean, even pretty prominent news outlets. And even at my own university for, you know, sometimes letting itself be used as a node of COVID misinformation. And, you know, my experience of pushing back, I don't think I've achieved anything at all. I've, you know, antagonized people. I've received threatening phone calls. So does this fall under the category of unchanneled anger, of anger that isn't actually productive and that I'd be better off without? Or is it potentially still the good kind because at some point it could yield results? I mean, how can we know which kinds are going to be productive?
Well, I think we need to change our perspective about what kind of productivity is, right? If we think that anger is only valuable if it brings about this massive amount of change, I think we shouldn't use it in that particular sense. Like I said before, you know, anger can be valuable when you don't have an audience, right? It's still able to do something in the world. Whether that's proclaimed value in a world, particularly value on lives that have been noted as not being valuable at all. So I wouldn't judge the inadequacy of your anger based on it achieving some grand goal, right? If that's the case, then we would suggest that Frederick Douglass's anger was never productive. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, so we should be kind and gracious with ourselves and also kind of get over ourselves in a little bit. So the fact that you were channeling and expressing your anger is productive.
So we have a related question from Bernie in San Francisco, who writes, Charles Duhigg wrote a good article on anger for The Atlantic a few years back, basically arguing that anger has three goals, which are to give voice that a wrong has been done, to pressure the actor who has committed the wrong to make amends, and if the first two fail, to exact revenge. Like, what do you think of that?
I agree with one and two and disagree with three, particularly because we get angry at our children. And if you are the kind of parent who's sitting right now plotting revenge for your children out of your anger, I don't know. Child Protective Services is somebody that we should call very quickly, right? But that's not the case. I don't think that's our experience. It's not the case. I don't want to say that it never happens. And if it does happen, right, if there is a desire for revenge, then we know that we have perhaps have a kind of destructive anger that I talk about, such as ripe rage or rogue rage or narcissistic rage, right? So I totally disagree with the notion that anger always conceptually has kind of like this desire for revenge. Aristotle would say that it has, but I disagree with Aristotle. Smart man, but I disagree with him. And I disagree with him based on just experience of our everyday lives. I've been angry a lot of times, as I've already indicated, and revenge is rarely a part of the picture. Trust me, never been arrested because I have not sought revenge. It's rarely part of the picture for me. So I want to disentangle that idea that revenge is always connected to anger.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about righteous rage with Maisha Cherry, author of The Case for Rage.
How can we channel our anger to make the world better? Should allies get mad on behalf of others, or should they put their own feelings aside? What can the movement for Black Lives teach other political movements about channeling our emotions?
Getting mad, getting even, or just getting to a better world? Plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. We got hella people, they got helicopters, they got the bombs, and we got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run. We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run. Could rage and anger lead to the guillotine? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Maisha Cherry from UC Riverside, and we're thinking about righteous rage.
So Maisha, if you could suggest one concrete way for activists to use their anger, what would it be?
Express it. I think a lot of us have a lot of suppressed and repressed anger. And particularly if you are a person of color or a minority, there are certain kinds of stereotypes around one's emotions, and one feels that if they express anger, then they will fulfill a particular negative stereotype about their group. We talked about violence earlier. One of the most noted reasons for why people resort to violence is because they don't have expressive resources that they hold it in, and they don't have ways to express their rage. And so I find it very, very important that if one is angry, that one should express it, whether that is expressing it and admitting it to oneself, to one's loved ones, whether one expresses to people that they're in solidarity with, whether they express it through art, express it.
So I have a question about witnessing others' anger. Which I think like most of us could get better at just listening and accepting that somebody else is angry. Mm. I think this is sometimes really hard to do, especially if you have a history with people getting angry at you and then maybe violent. So do you have advice for people who want to get better at it?
Yeah, I mean, if we had time, I'd talk about how Adam Smith thought about this stuff. And one of the things that he kind of lays out in his theory of moral sentiments is he talks about how it feels to witness someone angry. And usually when we do that, it's a very, I mean, we have witnessed someone angry. It's uncomfortable at times. And particularly if we see somebody angry at someone else, we immediately begin to empathize for the person who is a target of the anger. It can be very uncomfortable. But one of the things that I want us to get comfortable with is the uncomfortable. Particularly when we know that the anger is in response to injustice, the best thing that we can do is to hear them out, allow them to express themselves. Because being an audience member in this particular regard, for lots of people, a lot of people don't care about the reasons why they're angry. And so being able to listen to them despite our discomfort, which is a social discomfort and can be a stereotypical discomfort, just listening to someone who is angry and listen to their claims can make them feel valuable, can make them feel heard in a world that doesn't listen to them or doesn't value them.
Let me take that same scenario from the other side. I'm going to be confessional again, right. I'm afraid. But I sometimes have conversations with family members. And what I've noticed is that if I talk about some case of injustice calmly, then they don't really react. I mean, they don't, in other words, they don't learn. They don't really pay much attention. Whereas if I then, move to, hey, I'm actually a little indignant about this injustice and you should be too, the response is often, oh, you're angry, you must be out of arguments. Or sort of worse, now we don't want to talk to you and we're done with you. And, I could say to them, you shouldn't be reacting that way, but that's not much help, right? I mean, that's a worry that people often raise about anger from a pragmatic standpoint, that sometimes this expression of anger that's totally justified has this unfortunate effect sometimes of causing people to stop paying attention. What on earth do we do about that?
I think there's a variety of ways to express one's anger. We have a tendency to think that anger looks like one thing, why it's being expressed, that it's loud, that it's overbearing. But my mother taught me at a very young age that she could be angry. She doesn't have to raise her voice. She doesn't even have to speak. She used to give me this eye, right? So there's a variety of ways to express one's anger. I kind of address insincere ways in which people try to police or to calm down the angry person. And, I want to challenge those people. And one of the things that I do, I mean, as much as I'm trying to defend anger and try to, come to the aid of people who are angry, I'm very much concerned with audience members, people who are likely to respond to your anger in that particular way, and to remind them about what's happening, about some of the biases and the kind of policing or gaslighting that may be occurring when we tell someone to calm down and they cannot be listened to until they calm down. So the challenge is not just for the angry, but those who are listening to their anger, to give anger space to do its job.
Yeah, so this actually makes me have like a bunch of questions about what to do in a hostile setting where your anger is not welcome, but maybe other things that you do are equally not welcome. Mm. So I think like there are some situations where people do not want to hear that the world around them is unjust. And so whatever way you present it, they will come up with a way, like a reason why that was the wrong way to present it, and they won't listen to you until you say it right.
Right.
And my approach to this is usually, well, that's a no-win situation. Once you see that you're in it, you're not really subject to criticism anymore for stating your case badly, because there was no good way of stating your case.
Right. I mean, this just goes back to Audre Lorde here, right? So she writes The Uses of Anger. She starts off in the talking about how she gave a speech to white feminists, and she's finished giving the speech, and she basically talks to a white feminist afterwards. And the white feminist says, "Tell me how you feel, but don't say it too loudly, or I cannot hear you." And Audre Lorde responds, and she says, "Is it the manner in which I speak, or is it because of what I have to say may challenge you to change your ways?" Right. So Audre Lorde was kind of keen on this and knew that kind of move, that it's not really the anger itself, that it's not really the manner in which she speaks. But people know that, hey, when you say that there's injustice that has just occurred, there's a wrongdoing that has just occurred, that it's a challenge for them not only to open up their eyes, but it's also a challenge for them to change as well. And in some ways, I mean, she doesn't use this language, but she wants to say that's a no-win situation, right? Until they are willing to change or transform their ways and open their eyes, and they're not yet ready for the anger. But to put the onus as if the problem is her, she challenges and suggests that it's not, it's you.
Can I ask about other things that you mentioned in the book? As because we've talked about a lot of sort of upsides of Lordian anger, of the righteous kind, both for the individual and for the and for society. But you do mention a couple of risks, right? I mean, so one is, of course, burnout, which we heard more about in the Roving Philosophical Report earlier. Another is error, like, you know, it's, you know, we're all human and we might sometimes make mistakes as to where we put our anger. But I wanted to ask particularly about something I think of as Sarandon rage. So yeah, back in 2015, 2016, there was, as you know, there were some folks, you know, Susan Sarandon, Slavoj Žižek, Cornel West, a bunch of other people sort of, who seemed to be so angry at centrist Democrats like Hillary Clinton that they were going around telling people, mm-hmm. you know, not to vote for her. And that, to my mind, was counterproductive ultimately to the cause of progress and justice. And so that's, I wonder if that's a kind of rage that, you know, one can understand psychologically where it comes from, but it's the kind that all those ancients worried about and maybe some of the Buddhists worried about, where it's sort of kind of running amok. And it's, you know, it's not well targeted and it's disproportionate and all those things like that.
And I also wonder if what we're really thinking about or what we're really concerned about is the issue of strategy. I mean, people are angry about the Democratic Party right now, directed towards the right group, right? I mean, that's us. That's the Democratic Project. Right. We have thought about things and it failed. It wasn't successful. I mean, I think that's just a Democratic Project. I don't want to say that that's a necessary or sufficient or conceptually a part of the picture of what it is to be angry is to have bad strategy. I think you can be angry and have a good strategy. You can be angry and have a bad strategy. And I think the challenge is that we got to be a little bit more strategic and a little bit more prudent about the kind of strategies that we put out there. But I'm curious, because even before you mentioned this particular anger, you talked about burnout. You talked about burnout. I mean, I like that because I love sports and particularly team sports. And one of the things that I learned playing sports as a kid, you know, particularly basketball, is that you, even as a starter, you play your minutes and then you sit down, rest on the bench, and another person come off the bench and they play in your particular position and everybody get a rest. Everybody take their turn. And when I think about being agents of change who perhaps is angry, hey, you're going to get tired on the battlefield. And it's good to get in solidarity with people and say, hey, I've been fighting in this fight. I am burnt out. My emotions just all over the place. I'm going to take a break. And it's good to know that you have someone else that can pick up the pieces. So one of the suggestions that I offer up in the book, as far as anger management techniques, is to make sure that one is in solidarity with other folk, that you're constantly, you know, taking a rest. And as you take a rest, perhaps you're encouraging those who are not taking a rest. But I believe in taking rest. I don't believe that one can be angry all the time. I think that's just impossible. But I think that one can be angry in ways in which can be detrimental to one's mental health. And when that begins to occur, then one should engage in self-care. And I believe that the community and those you're in solidarity with is there to help you engage in that. And they are able to work in your place until you're able to get back on the field.
So I have a little question about anger on behalf of others, which I worry about as a type of anger. So on the one hand, like, anger for yourself or a group you're part of makes a lot of sense as self-respect and as, like, I don't know, building a more just world. On the other hand, I'm just thinking about, like, white feminists who are like burkas. Burkas are the biggest feminist problem facing Middle Eastern women.
Right.
Which is, like, sort of misplaced. And I think anger about it is sort of misplaced. And I'm trying to put my finger on exactly what's wrong with it. But something's wrong with it.
Yeah. So Serene Kadar, who's a philosopher from Brooklyn College, has a wonderful book about transnational feminism. And she talks about that particular position, which she calls the missionary position. But I would say this, that I also don't believe in the particular concept of being angry on someone else's behalf, right? Particularly because when we think that somebody else is experiencing a problem and only they are victims to that particular problem or affected that particular problem, then we have a kind of messed up conception about what it means to be in community and be co-citizens with people, right? So when I think about, for example, white allies in the anti-racist struggle, I don't want a white ally to feel anger on behalf of Black people or anger on behalf of brown people, right? Because racism affects us all, although differently, right? Racism still affects us all. King talked about this, James Baldwin talked about this, that when you have injustice in the world, a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, right? When we're part of a democratic project and certain kinds of individuals are not getting certain kinds of rights, then you don't live in a just world, right? You're not living in a society that is living up to its particular ideas. And therefore, you should do something about it, right? We are all part of this particular political project, this democratic project. And so we should be angry that our society as a whole has racism, has sexism. And so we can be in solidarity and be angry with other people. But when you find yourself being angry on behalf of someone else, then you have a skewed vision about what it is to be in community with people.
That's beautifully said. Thank you so much for joining us today, Maisha.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Maisha Cherry, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, and author of The Case for Rage, Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. So Ray, what are you thinking now?
So Maisha has told us a lot about anger and activism, and I'd been thinking also about anti-racist struggle, and particularly about some philosophy books that our listeners might be interested in about anti-racist struggle that have come out pretty recently. So first, we've got a book by a former guest, Christopher LeBron, who was on Philosophy Talk some time ago. And he's just had a book recently called The Making of Black Lives Matter, A Brief History of an Idea. There's a collection of essays by Angela Davis called Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement. And there's an edited collection by Tommy Shelby and Brandon Terry, To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr. And so I encourage our readers to check all those books out.
That is a great list. And we'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, fast and furious, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, large emotions are forever thrown at us in the form of entertainment. 12 Angry Men, Rage Against the Machine, Rage, Dorsey Scott as a sheep rancher in a rampage, Rage, Nicolas Cage as a mob guy in a rampage, Fury, Brad Pitt in a Sherman tank in a rampage. Near as I can tell, large emotions exist mainly in movies and books. Rage often shows up in hand-to-hand combat. The Irish hero Cuchulainn would get so enraged before a battle he'd puff up into a raging monster. Just point him in the right direction and get out of the way. We're wolves. That's uncontrolled rage right there in a metaphorical form. I have felt rage myself, mostly in junior high school. This is before children were allowed to take guns to school, but it did lead to fistfights. Big emotions lead to big trouble. They are linked with the seven deadly sins, but also with morality, as in righteous anger, as in an angry god. And if rage is a sin, we're complicit. Don't annoy Bruce Banner. If you wake up Hulk, it's on you. In video games, we see lots of amok berserkers, but they were created to entertain. We almost never write in anger. You wind up stabbing the page with your ballpoint pen, and the point is lost. Your notebook in shreds. This is why people turn to computers. Typing something on a laptop is soothing. The finger clicks like the ticking of a grandfather clock. Dialing down anger and something that can bear the weight of the barrage of cliches that comes with posting things online. Thanks to the internet, all writing is magically transformed into content, where your strong opinions join an army of faceless Twitterati in a performative display of anger that vanishes as soon as you exit the app. Right or wrong, rage does not generally translate into coherent action. Sometimes when people get angry, they get so darn mad they throw their phone across the room. I have seen this dozens of times in movies. In the real world, that's usually as close as you get to a murderous rage, even though it pops up a lot in Twitter comments. Conservatives actually do feel rage, I think, but they repress it so they can trigger libs to act up, so they can call the cops. Bunch of Karens, that make me so mad. January 6th was supposedly fueled by rage, but the crowd didn't seem that mad once they got inside the building. Some seemed downright gleeful, like they snuck into the movie and didn't get caught. Also displayed was whatever that emotion is when you get away with shoplifting. They were wandering around like tourists without a tour guide. Fervor seemed to be missing. Godzilla, there's another rage exemplar. Most of the time he just hangs out on Monster Island, storing up radiation and playing volleyball with his kid. But get him mad, whew, next thing you know, skyscrapers are being blasted to flinders by the force of his breath. We don't know what rage is anymore, which is why we need monsters to display it. Politicians in the public eye often talk about being angry about something, but we never actually see angry politicians, except Bernie Sanders. But he always seems angry, so rage is nothing special. We see a senator frowning on a Sunday morning chat show, but he's just irritated because he has to pretend to be angry about a thing that might not even exist, like critical race theory or colonizing Mars or global warming. Even for Americans, well-practiced in self-delusion, it's hard to get worked up, even about treason or a possible civil war. Everybody's mad about something, but all we see are frowns, headshakes, forced grins, and eye rolls. Alex Jones and the Hulk are perhaps the foremost avatars of rage we have. Mr. Jones seemed to be slowly fading from the public eye, and the Hulk is only occasionally a problem. The rest of the time, he's mild-mannered Bruce Banner, looking about in dismay at the ruins of another suit of clothes. As with so many things, rage seems to be a product of another time, back when we would fight mano a mano on a field of battle. One side would be naked giants, painted blood red, rebel yelling, ululating, making the ground shake with their feet as they thundered into battle, trilling great iron spears one-handed as they advanced, screaming. That'd scare me, but you know, today we just call it an airstrike and go take a nap. No sense getting mad about these things. God gave us drones for a reason. I gotta go.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take it anymore!